has to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Listeners do support this program, and I want to single out Robert Mendez da Costa and Eileen Weber. PayPal doesn't tell me where you're located, but I thank you for your financial support of the Peter B. Collins Show.
Smiling faces sometimes pretend to be your friend.
You can help too, and if you can, I appreciate it. Just log on to peterbcollins.com, and you can take out a voluntary subscription for as little as $5 a month.
Smiling faces, smiling faces sometimes. They don't tell the truth.
In this program, a one-on-one conversation with Professor David Ray Griffin about two of his recent books. He's published 35 books over his career. And these two books focus on the collapse of World Trade Center Building 7 and on the fate of Osama bin Laden. And before we get started, I want to dedicate this program to two individuals who opened my eyes and my mind to think critically and skeptically about what we've been told happened on September 11th, 2001. They are Michael Dietrich, a medical doctor and pilot, who first came to me with questions about NORAD and the FAA and their significant failures on 9/11. And also Kyle Hentz, who I met in Washington when I went to observe the work of the 9/11 Commission. He's been a tireless advocate and spokesman for the 9/11 families, the Jersey girls, and the first responders who continue to pay quite a price for those events. I thank those two gentlemen, as well as my guest for this conversation, Professor David Ray Griffin, whose work on 9/11 has been tireless, scholarly, and while he delves into complex technical issues, he always explains things in plain language and asks the questions that our media, our elected officials, and many others have failed to even imagine. Professor, welcome back to our program.
Good to be back with you, Peter.
Well, it's nice to talk with you. And before we get started, I wanted to acknowledge that there's an effort underway to launch a new investigation into the events of September 11th. And this is a matter that could go on the ballot in New York City this fall. But there is an effort to derail this, even though they have supplied the required signatures, and it's been acknowledged that this ballot measure for New York City has qualified. And this is happening pretty soon after we release this podcast, but I want you to know on Sunday, September 27th, the New York City Coalition for Accountability Now, NYC CAN, which is a group comprising 9/11 family members, first responders, and survivors, will march from Battery Park to City Hall in protest of the city's attempt to block the referendum for a fresh probe of 9/11 attacks. And I hope they are successful. Dr. Griffin, what do you think we need in terms of a new investigation? One of the things that I've articulated is that it would probably be best if the nexus were not in Washington or New York, because I think that there's a beltway in Washington and there's a kind of force field in New York that it tends to make it difficult to penetrate the mythology that we have been fed about 9/11.
I think that may be more true of Washington than it is of New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, I'm not sure it matters too much where it is. It's a matter of who it is,
yeah,
and whether we've got anybody there who can just really look at the evidence without preconception to reject it.
Mm-hmm.
Because by now the evidence is so strong, it's so overwhelming, the number and quality and kinds of professionals who have spoken out, from architects to pilots to veterans to intelligence officers to firefighters and, you know, everybody in the professions that are relevant to 9/11. We've got all these organizations now of professionals. You don't have anything comparable on the other side. The only people who defend the official story are people who are in the government or in agencies that are headed up by Bush loyalists, such as the 9/11 Commission, headed up by Philip Zelikow, who is mm-hmm. essentially a member of the 9/11 Commission, or the NIST report, NIST being an agency of the Commerce Department, so mm-hmm. it was an agency of the Bush administration during all those years. So, you know, and then you've got other people who may be engineers who their jobs depend upon they're keeping quiet or mouthing the official story because they're dependent upon government contracts, all sorts of scientists. But if you weed out all those people who have a vested interest in at least publicly stating they accept the story, you cannot find people who will defend it who have any professional knowledge about it. And likewise, you can't find any of those people who will defend the official story in public debate against, you know, informed members of the 9/11 truth movement.
Mm-hmm.
So if we just can get some people on there with something approaching an open mind, then it's going to go pretty well.
And the conundrum is that we need government involvement for subpoena power, for access to materials that are improperly classified, for access to a great wealth of information and sources. And at the same time, we can't trust the government structure because we know what happened with the Kane-Hamilton-Zelikow Commission. And so I'm torn about this because I certainly want to get to the truth. We deserve to know it. And I don't pretend to know exactly what it is. I know that what we've been told doesn't square with the physical evidence and doesn't pass basic smell tests, whether they're about physics or credibility of you know, various people who have provided information. And so it's a challenging undertaking in that respect. And we recently saw that Van Jones was forced out of the Obama administration. He was not a cabinet officer. He was a mid-level White House appointee. And I know Van a little bit. We're not best friends, but I have great respect for this man. And the thing that the Glenn Beck cabal really played up was that he had signed a petition calling for a new investigation into 9/11. And that was then parlayed pretty quickly by this spin-happy media and, in my view, passive politicians into a kind of parody that those who seek the truth about 9/11 are as crazy as the right-wingers who deny that Obama was born as an American citizen. And so we see the efforts to marginalize, ridicule, and dismiss thoughtful people like Van Jones, who simply signed a petition calling for a new investigation.
Well, yes, exactly. And a point that I'm trying to get more fully out there for people who still may have an open mind is that, whereas the assumption behind that movement, that if you sign this, therefore you're something's wrong with your mind,
mm-hmm.
and so you're not fit to be in the government, the exact opposite is the truth. If you believe the official story and have any idea what the official story is, some of the details of it, then there is something wrong with your mind,
mm-hmm.
because you simply cannot believe the official story about the Twin Towers or Building 7 unless you believe in miracles. And in this case, you would have to believe that Allah performed the miracle if you believe that Al-Qaeda was responsible for bringing the buildings down.
Mm-hmm.
And let me stress why that is. Let me illustrate it with Building 7.
Sure.
There had been a long-standing controversy as to whether Building 7 came down at free-fall acceleration.
Mm-hmm.
The rate of, if you drop a brick off the top of the building, and going through the air, we're talking about free-fall through the air, not
right.
a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
And if the building came down in free-fall, the roof, the top floor, would have reached the ground at the same time the brick reached the ground. That would have meant that the top floor of the building went through the other 41 floors, with absolutely no resistance.
Right.
Well, we all know that's impossible. All that concrete, and particularly all that steel, 82 steel columns, just can't kind of jump out of the way or just melt into nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So free fall means zero resistance. That means everything has to be now. Now, what the 9/11 Truth Movement had always said is virtual free fall.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as the NIST group was getting ready to put out their final report, they put out a preliminary report for public comment in August of last year, and they said, free fall, you guys are talking about free fall, nowhere close to free fall, 40% slower than free fall, which would still be very fast. But
yeah,
nevertheless,
we're talking about seconds.
Yeah, yeah. And, well, David Chandler, who's a high school physics professor, who lives there in the Bay Area, he put out a video and showed that it not only was virtual free fall, but for 2.5 seconds, it was absolute free fall. So that means for about the first 2.5 seconds of the building coming down, it was encountering absolutely no resistance. And he put that on YouTube. He actually confronted the 9/11 Commission with it, and lo and behold, this was also a miracle. When they put out their final report in November, they said there were 2.25 seconds. They quibbled about 0.25 seconds. 2.25 seconds of gravity or free fall. And they still kept the previous theory, which was the theory of progressive collapse based on fire, which meant that the columns came down in not all suddenly at once, but in an order. You know, 79 goes down, and then it knocks 80 down, and then it knocks 81 down, and then all the others go down in order. Well, that can't happen instantaneously. And Sundar, who's the Shyam Sundar, who's the head of the NIST team that put out this report, he explained this. He said not everything can happen at once, and it can't be free fall. But when they went into their November report, they said, well, okay, it's free fall. But they didn't change their theory. So they have a theory that rules out free fall, and yet, as an empirical fact, they admit free fall. And so that would be a miracle, because you would be violating one of the most fundamental principles of Newtonian physics. We're talking about junior high physics here.
And just a quick, I think, correction here. You mentioned Chandler confronted the 9/11 Commission. I think you meant NIST, right?
Yeah, the NIST. This
yes.
was at the, it was called the World Trade Center 7 Technical Briefing.
Mm-hmm.
And I discussed that at great length in my book. Thanks
yes, you
for
do.
That correction.
Yeah.
Now, let me add a thing here, since you brought up Van Jones. And so my point is, people who say something's wrong with Van Jones's mind, they need to understand that there has to be something wrong with your mind if you know what's in the 9/11, all these official reports, and you still say you believe them. So
mm-hmm.
either you're being dishonest, or you're simply ignorant about the facts, or in this case, the basic facts of physics.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's a rather amazing thing that was sent to me last night. There's a magazine, a well-known old magazine in England called the New Statesman. This is a left-wing magazine. You're probably familiar with it.
I've heard of it. Mm-hmm.
It's been around for about 100 years, and most of us know it because it's the vehicle that John Pilger writes most of his articles for. Mm-hmm. And so you know this is, they allow very hard-hitting stuff in there. But like a lot, and actually the majority of the left-wing organizations, they keep their distance from what they call conspiracy theories, refusing to admit that the official story about 9/11 is the original conspiracy theory.
Indeed.
And they want to ridicule us and say that, we're a terrible thing because we discredit the left and all of this. Well, nevertheless, in this magazine, the cover story is called 50 People Who Count in the World Today. And, of course, President Obama is number one. Hugo Chavez is number 44, for example.
Okay.
Osama bin Laden, in spite of the fact he's dead, is number 8. But you see, he's been falling down a little bit. He's, a few years ago, he would have been the most important person. I guess being dead might hurt your influence.
It cuts into it, yeah.
But nevertheless, the point I'm getting to is that yours truly, believe it or not, is number 41.
Really?
Really, I was shocked, and then secondly, I was rather upset because it used to be in the 80s, I'd go to the gym, and these little old ladies would come up to me, think they're giving me a compliment, and say, you know, you look just like our President Bush, meaning, you know, George Sr.
Uh-huh.
And I always hated that. The idea that I looked anything like George Bush, and of course he's 41,
mm-hmm.
and here I am 41. Anyway, here's what they say about me, and they don't call me conspiracy theorist. They give category because they use that for Dan Brown, and by the way, he was number 50.
Oh,
so somehow I matter a little more than Dan Brown. That's a little hard to believe, but nevertheless.
It's just a more recent conspiracy.
Yeah. Now, yeah, this is a little more recent than Jesus and Mary and so on. Now, it is a backhanded compliment. Here's what they say. Conspiracy theories are everywhere, and they always have been. In recent years, one of the most pernicious global myths has been that the U.S. government carried out, or at least colluded in, the 11 September 2001 attacks as a pretext for going to war. David Ray Griffin, a retired professor of religion, is the high priest of the truther, quote-unquote, movement. His books on the subject have lent a sheen of respectability. No reference to Charlie Sheen, of course.
Thank you.
Lent a sheen of respectability that appeals to people at the highest levels of government, from Michael Meacher to, you guessed it, Anthony Van Jones, who was recently forced to resign as Barack Obama's Green Jobs advisor after it emerged that he had signed a 9/11 truth petition in 2004. So, first of all, when you get over the shock of this and realize that's, you know, quite a big thing to recognize the 9/11 truth movement as something quite important, even if it's important in a pernicious way.
And I thank you for the sheen that you've given it.
And so, but then the point here is that they ended the piece with that, or the little paragraph on me, it looks like, to show that obviously what I'm saying is false and not to be taken seriously in polite company, because Van Jones had to resign because he was influenced by this kind of nonsense.
Well, I think it's a really sad commentary, and I posted a blog item, and I have ranted about this on my podcast, Professor, that I think that the Obama team really blundered in giving the scalp of Van Jones to Glenn Beck and the lobby groups that are supporting him and that are also promoting the the gun-toting mobsters at town hall meetings. And I think that this and their acquiescence on the Acorn lynching, if you will, is a series of mistakes in misjudging the other side and the extent to which they can create these characterizations and essentially sell them through to the American public.
Yeah, one would wish that at some point they would say enough of caving in to nonsense. Now, I can understand you've got a whole bunch of battles to wage, and there are going to be certain battles you just say, well, look, this is too bad, but we just can't be distracted by doing that. I understand that. But, you know, in this case and in some of the other cases, you know, you would like to see a little spine, a little fight back. And, you know, this will just simply encourage the Glenn Becks of the world and say, well, we've succeeded. Now what's our next big one? So, yes, it's very disappointing. And mm-hmm. particularly, you know, for somebody like me who knows how easy it would be to defend him, because all you would have to do, you wouldn't have to say, oh, sure, yeah, 9/11 is an inside job, so, you know, we haven't said anything about that because we're looking forward, not backwards. But, of course, that's true. No, they don't have to say that. All they have to say is, you know, there are some legitimate questions that have been raised, like, and you could list a few, like, you know, the contradiction as to what time Cheney went down in the underground thing, the fact that the 9/11 commissioners have said they weren't able to interview any of the CIA people who interviewed people such as KSM who were telling the stories about. So you could give a few kind of innocuous things.
Mm-hmm.
You could mime. I even point out, well, you know, our own FBI says they have no hard evidence that Osama bin Laden was responsible. Of course, they're not going to say that one when that's the reason we're in Afghanistan.
Well, and you could even stay above some of that detail, Professor, and just say that the co-chairs, Kane and Hamilton themselves, have repudiated their support for the bestseller that they published called the 9/11 Report.
Yeah, and that to some extent,
yeah,
limited repudiation.
Yeah, they have acknowledged that it's at minimum not the complete story.
Yeah, and so there'd be different ways you could do it that would be, it would not inflict any damage on them, and yet they could have said. So lots of reasonable people can sign a petition like this and say, well, yeah, sure, we could use another investigation. Yeah. So
well, they could have. And I also, I've been very clear that I am skeptical. I don't believe the official story. I don't believe the work of the 9/11 Commission. I have pursued some hypotheses and alternate scenarios, but I have never made a statement that I believe it was an inside job. I believe we need further investigation to determine that. I think that is a very plausible scenario, but I don't go to that point partly because of the way people are decapitated when they do advance theories like that.
Sure, and if I was in your business, probably wouldn't either. You know, it's your job as a reporter to report and raise questions and give people, I mean, as somebody doing this kind of show, it's to give them a platform to argue their case.
Mm-hmm.
It's not for you to argue a case.
Mm-hmm.
So, sure, that's a different matter. So, in any case, I thought this was pretty interesting, and I'm kind of wondering if the very fact that this Van Jones thing came up just shortly before this article came out, I bet that could have influenced their opinion and said, well, you know, this is still a continuing story, so mm-hmm. let's include it on the top 50, because you can imagine how many hundreds of people they had to select from, people and movements, to lift up as the most important 50. So mm-hmm. it could be that Van Jones did us a service in that respect, or that Glenn Beck did us a service in that respect.
Well, Professor, over the years that I've been delving into this area of inquiry, when I talk to people about it, I often lead with the issues of Building 7, because I think that it offers the clearest example that no airplane struck it, the debris from the North and South Towers may have tinged the building, but, you know, there's no physical evidence or photographic evidence that showed that there was a huge impact that destabilized Building 7.
Oh, and NIST now even says that mm-hmm. Even though Popular Mechanics had said they were going to make a big deal about structural damage from debris from the North Tower, and that was what they based their thing on, saying, no, they're not going to say fire alone for the first time did it, you 9/11 truthers are crazy, and so on. NIST came out and said, it's almost entirely fire that brought the building down. Structural damage played no significant role. All the North Tower debris did significantly was start a fire, and that mm-hmm. was it. Start some fires.
Yeah. And so I believe that because also it came down later in the day, and that because there's no dispute that it was in free fall for a couple of seconds, and that if we back away from technical specificity, the building more or less came down in a free fall, more or less within its own footprint. And as you point out in the book, the debris field was only a couple of stories tall. This was a 41-story building?
42.
42-story building that...
Excuse me, 47.
47, okay, that collapsed and left only two stories of debris. And as you point out in the book, they try to make the case that the building essentially cracked, or the structural design failed between floors 7 and 14. But that still, as you say, leaves more than 400 feet of vertical steel that somehow was crunched down and somewhat disintegrated into a pile that was only two stories high. And that, to me, just speaks volumes, that fires inside the building, even with the fantastical scenarios and computer renderings that NIST has put together, cannot possibly explain that this building came down in the way it did, and that there were not shards of steel sticking out at you know, jungle gym angles, because, you know, for it to be such a neat demolished package really is, you know, circumstantial evidence that it was a controlled demolition.
Yeah, I'm glad you picked up that point, because it's a point that hadn't been made by many people before. A few had, but it hadn't been a big point like free fall and some of the other things. And I do close the book with that, mm-hmm. Because I think that makes a very nice capstone, because that's something that's just readily understandable, because it's visualizable, that you got 47 stories, and they're going to say that about 7 to 10 of the stories fail. That still leaves you with almost 40 stories of steel there, and the mm-hmm. idea that that could all be neatly packed into a very small area is intuitively self-evident that that can't be true.
Well, and you have all the stuff in the interior, the doors and partitions and desks and cubicles and file cabinets and bookcases and all that stuff, and they never make the claim that every floor had a fire, and so that debris by itself would you know, leave an unruly pile, not this relatively neat two-story inside the footprint of the building debris field that actually resulted.
Yes, and so that brings me back to my point that there are so many things about the visual story that if people will look at them with a semi-open mind, at least, they can just see the visual story can't be true. And this is just one of dozens of such obvious facts.
Now, Professor, in your book, you go into some detail about the coverage of the 9/11 events in real time by BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation.
Yes.
And one of the stories that many people are familiar with is that the BBC broadcast a report of the fall of Building 7 about 25 minutes before it actually occurred. And I've seen that footage of the female BBC reporter who's doing what they call a stand-up. She's on a building north of the World Trade Center in Manhattan. And over her shoulder, you can clearly see that Building 7 is still standing, even as she reports that the building has come down. And that's an anomaly that is still unexplained. But you go into more detail about some of the failings of the BBC, both during the live coverage and in some documentaries that it has produced since. Give us a sketch of that, please.
Yeah, that's a big one. As I say, I don't make too much of that because of the early announcement. In fact, CNN announced quite a bit earlier than BBC did.
Mm-hmm.
So if people should have been shouting more at CNN, but somehow the BBC show got more coverage, partly because there was that very dramatic picture of Jane Stanley with the building standing behind her.
Mm-hmm.
But I said, you know, it could have been one of these deals where, you know, as a kid we used to play these games where you'd be in a circle and you whisper something in your person's ear next to you, and then it goes around the circle. It gets clear around the circle. It's changed dramatically. Stories do get changed. People mishear, misinterpret, misspeak, so on. And so what was clear was that it was known by about noon, widely known, reported that the building was going to come down.
Mm-hmm.
So people could have been talking about that, and somewhere along the way that could have become the building has come down.
And you detail that firefighters were told to move away, and so, yes, there were multiple sources of speculation in the early hours of the afternoon of 9/11 that Building 7, for some reason, was going to come down.
Yeah, so what I say is that we shouldn't try to use that as really proof that the media had been told ahead of time that Building 7 was going to come down, and for some reason or another, they jumped the gun.
Mm-hmm.
It does point in that direction. I could say it's evidence for that, but it is not conclusive evidence for that. We shouldn't make too big a deal out of it.
Okay.
But what it is dramatic evidence of is the fact that it was widely known that the building was going to come down. Well, why would that be when there was no earthly reason, a visible, observable reason to people on the ground that the building would come down? You know, buildings like this just don't come down. And you could say, well, the towers had just come down, but at the time people were saying, well, that was very strange too, but of course they had been hit by planes, and so maybe they destabilized, and a lot of people who didn't know they were built for that and all that, they could say, okay, but Building 7, not hit by a plane, does not have the big fires in it that the towers did for a while. Small fires on only really six floors where they lasted for what NIST calls a sustained fire, which may mean only 40 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
They want to claim that they lasted, 6-7 hours, but they have no evidence for that. But nevertheless,
well, and
only
you,
on six
you,
floors.
You also shred their timeline in a way that undermines much of their scenario.
That's right, yeah. So I say their claims are not borne out by their empirical evidence.
Mm-hmm.
In any case, my point is that there would have been no reason for people at the scene to think the building was going to come down unless they had inside knowledge. So the very fact that the rumor started going around, and it not only was a rumor, it was so strong that they physically moved all the firefighters out of the building and then moved them so many blocks away so that if the building fell down sideways, it wouldn't kill them.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty strong hunch the building's going to come down. In other words, they knew the building was going to come down. The only question was when. Mm-hmm. And I would say, you know, when are those explosives going to finally work?
Well, and you also give some detail of concern from firefighters who said, why aren't we in there putting out the fires? You know, it's not like we can save building one or two anymore. And it was very clear that the command decision was made to just let Building 7 go.
Yeah, these were really trivial fires. And, in fact, they're so sporadic, it does look like somebody's in there setting them, and then they die out. And so then it blossoms up somewhere else on the floor. You know, they don't seem to even be continuous fires. So they were not... big blazing, all engulfing fires, and they were the kind of fires that those guys could have gone in on those six floors and had them out within an hour. So you had two levels of people. You had one level of people in the fire department who said the buildings are coming down, and then you had other people who were saying, "That's crazy. There's no reason in the world these buildings should be coming down. We should be in there putting the fires out."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it does show you that some people in the fire department were, there was inside knowledge in the fire department.
Mm-hmm. Now let me read a quote from that you have in the book here. Richard Porter, the head of news for BBC, responded to a whole raft of emails that BBC received, and he has this rather remarkable explanation. I put that in air quotes. "We're not part of a conspiracy. Nobody told us what to say or do on September 11th. We didn't get told in advance that buildings were going to fall down. We didn't receive press releases or scripts in advance of events happening. If we reported the building had collapsed before it had done so, it would have been an error. No more than that." Well, first of all, his use of the conditional, "if we reported," I don't think that's in contention. It was an error, all right? Well, how do you make an error like that? You know, it reminds me of a story about Pierre Salinger, and the phrase was that he had accurately predicted seven of the last five Mideast peace deals. And so how do you make an error about something that is prospective?
That's right. And so it really was a remarkable statement. He protested too much. I mean, he is almost like he took everything that had happened and said, "This didn't happen, this didn't happen, this didn't. We weren't given a script," and so on. So I took his statement as the strongest evidence that it was, you know, that they were given a script.
Mm-hmm.
In any case, your question that I got sidetracked on was, what were their other failings? Well, mm-hmm. there are many, many, many. Let's focus on
Hess and Jennings.
Yeah, the main one I deal with is their treatment of Barry Jennings. Many of your listeners know that Barry Jennings reported on 9/11 that morning that he and Michael Hess, who was Giuliani's good friend, whom Giuliani had made his top lawyer in New York City, that is the corporation counsel.
Mm-hmm. And he was also a partner in Giuliani's juice firm?
Yes, and they are now partners.
Mm-hmm.
They got there early that morning. The deal was that whenever there was an emergency, they're supposed to go to the Emergency Management Center, which was on the 23rd floor of Building 7.
Mm-hmm.
So they got up there. The first plane hit, of course, at 8:46, so they got up there about 9 o'clock, and everybody's gone. And so they ask what they're supposed to do. They're told on the telephone, get out of there fast. The elevator doesn't work. They start running down the stairs. They get to the 6th floor. Huge explosion knocks the landing out from under them. They climb back up to the 8th floor, break a window, call for help, and the firefighters come to help them, but then they run away. The firefighters come back again later, and then they run away again. And Jennings later realized that's when the two towers came down, the first time they ran away and then the second time they ran away. So they would have got rescued around 11 o'clock and then or so. And by 11:57, Hess is a quarter to about a third of a mile away or something like that, several blocks away, giving an interview near City Hall. So obviously he had to be rescued by no later than 11:30. Okay.
And that conflicts with the NIST timeline, and that has created an opening that the BBC took advantage of.
That's right. So what NIST said, in fact, what Giuliani said in a book that he wrote in 2002 about his good friend Michael Hess getting trapped in Building 7, he said he got trapped at 10:28 when debris from the North Tower rained on Building 7 and blocked his way. Well, when you go back and see Jennings' story, you see, no, they're there at 9 o'clock. They ask what to do. They run down the stairs. We're talking more like 9:15 than 10:28. So NIST is, Giuliani was off by about an hour and a quarter, at least an hour. But then NIST picks that up as the official account and put it in a report that came out in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
And then they claimed that they were not rescued then because Hess had said they were trapped for an hour and a half. Well, you had an hour and a half to 10:28 or 10:30, you got noon.
Mm-hmm.
And so they couldn't have been rescued before noon. So NIST said, oh, they were rescued about 12:10 or 12:15. Well, we've got proof that that's false. We've got the audio of Hess doing that. And I put that on the on a website, so you can Google that. Anybody can listen to that.
Okay.
Now, what the Jennings then, he had done this interview for Dylan Avery for Loose Change, Final Cut.
Mm-hmm.
Then he started getting word that he may lose his job, so he begged Dylan to not put it in the film. Dylan didn't put it in the film. But then Jennings went over and did an interview for the BBC. And then the BBC twisted the timeline. Now, they wouldn't admit this, of course, but I can't believe that Jennings would have told them a different story than he told Dylan. No reason for him to tell a different story. He was adamant about it. He said very clearly that when the explosion occurred, both towers were still standing.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the BBC is saying that what it says, the narrator says, early reports of an explosion were simply debris from a falling tower.
Mm-hmm.
Then Michael Rudin, who headed up that show, he wrote in his blog, 9/11 truthers or self-styled truthers have claimed that we distorted the timeline. Well, so we're putting out a new show now, a new version of the show that has Michael Hess in it. He was there, and he confirms our timeline. Well, when did this second show occur? The next thing that developed after Jennings had done his interview with them and the show had come on, then NIST was to put out its report in August 21st of last year. 2 days before that, August 19th, Barry Jennings suddenly dies.
Of?
53-year-old man, and we cannot get any word whatsoever of why he died. There is a report that he died in a hospital, but there's no possibility of contact with his family. They have completely disappeared off the face of the earth. And Dylan hired a crack private investigator. She was known to be very good, and used his credit card to give her quite a sizable sum of money, he said, to go find out what she could about how Barry Jennings died. A day later, he gets an email from her saying, I have reversed the charges. I've returned your money. Please never contact me about this man again. I've determined this is a matter for the police.
Mm.
So, as Dylan said, this doesn't sound like someone who discovered that Jennings had died innocently in his sleep. Well, then the BBC does its second show. Now that Jennings is dead, Hess speaks out for the first time in all these years. He never said a word all these years, and now suddenly speaks up, and lo and behold, as Rudin says, he confirms our chronology. So I deal at great length in the book with Michael Hess's new testimony, in which he says, oh, yes, on that day I thought there was an explosion, but now I know that it was just debris from building Tower 1, the North Tower. And I show there are so many contradictions in his account that it's just utterly unbelievable. So that Rudin's statement that he confirms our timeline, no, he supports their timeline. He supports it verbally. But confirmation only occurs if your account is credible.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael Hess's account is absolutely not credible. And he is now a business partner still, again, with Giuliani.
Yeah.
So, you know, the fact that BBC wouldn't even mention that and say, well, of course he's got a big conflict of interest. He couldn't possibly, you know, say that what Giuliani had said in his book was false. This is the dishonesty of the BBC. This organization has so crumbled in recent years, and particularly since they started defending the official story about 9/11, that for people in around the world who know what is going on, they have just lost enormous credibility.
Yeah, yeah, it is sad because, especially during the Bush era, we often looked to British journalism to bring us the truth about issues. And the Guardian, the Independent, many freelance journalists have done an excellent job. But the taxpayer-funded BBC has been compromised in much the way that Bush was successful in neutering public television in this country and essentially striking fear into them that if they countered the administration line too aggressively, that their funding would be cut.
Yeah, it looks like the same thing happened there, that because early on with 9/11, they were putting out some stories that conflicted with the official story, like some reports of alleged hijackers who were still alive. They did two of those reports, and then a couple years ago, they actually go back and disown their own reports, and on a completely fallacious basis, and I dealt with that in my previous book, that is the New Pearl Harbor Revisited,
mm-hmm.
and show that both they and then also Der Spiegel, which also used to be a great magazine, just absolutely flat out lie. They say, oh, it was just mistaken identity. They didn't know this guy, Waleed al-Shiri, wasn't the same guy. Because, and he didn't know that they were, you know, because the photo had not appeared. So he didn't know that they were really blaming another guy. They weren't blaming this Waleed al-Shiri. Well, no, the photos had appeared when he showed up at the American embassy and pointed out he was not dead. Therefore, he had not been on Flight 11.
Mm-hmm.
So it is really sad to see the degree to which we've lost, around the world, we've lost the Fourth Estate. It's just now an extension of the government, and mainly the executive branch.
We're talking with David Ray Griffin, the author of a series of books about the 9/11 issues, and the newest one is The Mysterious Collapse of World Trade Center 7, subtitled Why the Final Official Report About 9/11 is Unscientific and False. And I want to come back to those last two key words in a bit. But first, I want to delve into some of the physical evidence and your ability to present contradictions to the statements that NIST published in its provisional report and then in its final report. And before we go into that, one thing I wanted to raise, Professor, is I had seen widely reported in the past that because there was this emergency management center located at Building 7, that there was a diesel tank on the roof to power generators. Maybe it wasn't even on the roof. That detail I may be misremembering. But I think I read every page of your book, and I don't recall any reference to diesel fuel at Building 7 at all.
Well, yes, I did in the introduction, where I talk about the background to the World Trade Center report. I reported that when FEMA put out its report in 2001, they gave a speculative, an imaginative account of how the building might have come down. And this involved a burning beam coming over from the North Tower and then setting the diesel fuel on fire, causing a towering inferno, which then brought the building down. But then they said, this is our best possible explanation, but it has a very low probability of occurrence, that famous statement. And popular mechanics over the years kept talking about the diesel. And, you know, ignoring the fact that all the photos show, the building was not a towering inferno at any stage along the way. You always had fires on only a few floors at any given time.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, they kept... So that was their big claim, that it was these two things that were would explain it. The enormous amount of structural damage caused by the debris from the North Tower, plus the diesel fuel in there. So what they were arguing was that Building 7 was essentially like the Twin Towers. So the structural damage was analogous to the structural damage caused by the planes in the towers, and the diesel fuel substituted for the jet fuel in the towers in order to get a big, big fire going.
Mm-hmm.
Well, NIST just rejected both of those, and so I mentioned that in early on in the book, and,
okay.
and then I never mention it again. You're right.
Mm-hmm. All right, so NIST has these theories that they've put forward, and you, in one sentence you capture it. You say, as we will see, NIST's theory involves implausible claims based on fudged data. And I think if people get lost in what we're about to talk about here in terms of temperatures and when steel is compromised and when it actually melts, that if you just focus on this, implausible claims and fudged data, I think that that's what Professor Griffin details in these chapters of the book. So first, let's talk about the fundamentals here. How many fires were there, and why is it that NIST tries to claim that fires were responsible for the implosion of Building 7?
Well, they try to claim that because that's their only possibility. They're being an agency of the U.S. government, and in that case, the Bush administration, they could not possibly say what they knew, which was that explosives brought down the building. And they couldn't appeal to planes like they did with the towers.
Yeah.
There were no plane impacts. It looked like they toyed a long time with making claims about the diesel and the structural damage, but finally gave those up. And so they finally had to rest the case on essentially fire alone.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why. And then with regard to an example of a fudged claim, I can use fire. They put out a report back in 2004 called Interim Report on World Trade Center 7. And in that document, they have photographs of the fires, and some of them have captions. And one of the photographs said there were fires at a certain time on a few floors. They mentioned the floors, but then they specifically said Floor 12 had completely burned out by 4:45. Okay, now flash forward to their 2008 report, in which they've developed this theory that it's essentially fire alone that brings the building down. So they've got to have some pretty big fires going during that last period. The building's going to come down at 5:21, so at 5 o'clock, and these were... You know, they did things on the hour. They show you where the fire was. They had graphics to show you where the fire was at 2 and at 3 and at 4 and at 5. And that's the last one. At 5 o'clock, they show an enormous fire on floor 12. At 5 o'clock, on floor 12, the same floor that they had said back in 2004 was completely burned out. So when I say fudged data, that is quite a fudge to go from inferno from completely burned out.
Well, and the stretch that they have made to, you know, propel this fire theory forward gets ridiculous. And, you know, if it weren't so tragic, it would be funny. But, you know, they even speculate about clean desk versus messy desk.
Oh, it is.
And how much combustible material would occur from file folders on a messy desk as opposed to those that are neatly stored in a metal file cabinet.
It gets so silly because they're going to claim that there are three floors on which that were crucial to bringing down the building. And so they have to claim that those floors had far more combustible material than all the other floors, and that's why they had such big fires and so on. And I show in some cases that the exact opposite is the truth. So not only is their stuff trivial, it's just false.
Yeah.
And let me give another example of, you know, I use the language there, fudge data. The technical terms are falsification and fabrication. They're just different in degree. Falsification, you take something that's there and you distort it. Fabrication, you just make it up out of whole cloth.
Right.
Well, they claim in their final report that one of the reasons the building came down, whereas no other steel frame building in history had ever come down because of fire, these were exceptional because of design differences. Well, one of the big design differences was, they said, that you've got these girders that reinforce the beams on the floors and the columns. They connect. And these girders didn't have any shear studs on them. Shear studs are really big, thick screws, essentially, that attach the girder to the floor beam, to the cement slab.
And the girder is a vertical, is that it?
No.
Okay, these are all horizontal. We're talking about...
They can be
about...
horizontal or diagonal.
Okay.
Is my understanding.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little above my pay grade here.
Well, you're well above mine, so don't worry.
There are things that connect other things and hold them from moving. And there's one girder that they say connected the crucial column 79, with attached to the floor around it and stabilized it. And that girder, because it didn't have shear studs, gave way and allowed this beam then, because the girder was no longer holding the beam in place, allowed this beam to expand like crazy. So this is their fire theory. What the fires did, didn't melt or weaken the columns. In this case, it elongated. They call it thermal expansion.
Mm-hmm.
Brought the building down because these beams expanded, elongated, and then it ran into the column and knocked the column over, and then that all hell broke loose, started a domino effect. And so it's crucial to them that the girder was not connected to the floor with shear studs, and that's why it didn't hold. Well, look back in that 2004 interim report, and you read, the girders and the beams were connected to the floor slabs with shear studs. In the report they put out in 2008, they quoted that sentence almost word for word, but just left out the word girders.
Mm-hmm.
And they said the floor beams were attached to the floor slabs with shear studs, but the girders weren't. Now, by the way, the same fellow, a guy named Chris Sarnes, who lives in the Bay Area, greater Bay Area, he made both of these discoveries. In fact, another discovery comparing these, where it's a similar lie, a similarly outrageous lie. So you've got these three glaring lies that are all disproved by NIST's own previous report. So those, it's that sort of thing which I, with some sort of understatement, was calling fudged data.
Well, some of it's caramel fudge, and some of it is fudge with nuts. Let me read. You quote a passage from the NIST report regarding this thermal expansion. And let me just read this into the record here for our listeners. Fire-induced thermal expansion of the floor system surrounding Column 79 led to the collapse of Floor 13. It's a 47-story building, which triggered a cascade of floor failures. In this case, the floor beams on the east side of the building expanded enough that they pushed the girder spanning between Column 79 and 44 to the west on the 13th floor. This movement was enough for the girder to walk off of its support at Column 79. The unsupported girder and other local fire-induced damage caused Floor 13 to collapse, beginning a cascade of floor failures down to the fifth floor. Many of the floors had already been at least partially weakened by the fires in the vicinity of Column 79, and this left 79 with insufficient lateral support. As a consequence, the column buckled eastward, becoming the initial local failure for collapse initiation. Now, Professor, I have no, you know, advanced schooling in physics. I'm a practical guy, and I'm sorry, my bullshit director goes off, a detector, when I read this. Because in simple terms, they're claiming that the epicenter here was floor 13. And if that's the case, there would be a huge pile of unmelted, unbroken steel above the remains of floor 13 and the areas below.
That's absolutely right. And so that gets us back to that problem of the debris field being so tiny and being so short.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just, I mean, it's just, so again, back to this point, that if people know what the official story, see, most of these people say, well, of course I accept the NIST report. They've never read the NIST report. The people who knew something about the August report don't know that they changed the final report to make it allow for free fall.
Mm-hmm.
And so people are signing on to believe miracles without knowing it, and then ridiculing people who question it because they can't stomach those miracles.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's the situation we're in, where we've got ideology combined with ignorance combined with indifference, and of course, you know the old joke, you know, which one's worse? I don't know, and I don't care.
So in closing this segment here, I want to come back to the final three words of your subtitle, why the final official report is unscientific and false. Take a moment to explain.
Yeah, because they simply violate the basic principles of scientific method, which is the two that I mentioned. You cannot falsify data, you cannot fabricate data, and then thirdly, the really big one, you cannot ignore data.
Mm-hmm.
And the first half of my book is about all the data that they ignore, the testimonies of explosions going off in Building 7 as well as the towers, the testimonies about molten steel under Building 7 as well as under the towers, the evidence of all sorts of things in the World Trade Center dust that shouldn't have been there, things that show that we had temperatures up to over 4,000 degrees Fahrenheit when fire couldn't have gotten even to 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit and certainly couldn't have heated steel anywhere close to that temperature, and yet there's evidence that, that steel melted. We have iron, which is a residue when steel is melted, say, with thermite. And then the most recent, the big discovery, that there was a nanothermite in the dust, lots of nanothermite. And nanothermite, whereas ordinary thermite is an incendiary, it starts fires,
mm-hmm.
Nanothermite is also a high explosive and a very powerful explosive indeed that ordinary mortals cannot get hold of. You have to be, it seems like only the military and people related to the military have this stuff. And NIST simply said NIST was asked by Stephen Jones and other people who were involved in this study, well, did you check the dust for thermite? And thermite is a class term. It includes nanothermite as well as ordinary thermite.
Mm-hmm.
And they just said no. And then when a reporter asked Michael Newman, the spokesperson for NIST, well, why didn't you check for thermite? Why didn't you check for explosives? He said, well, because there was no evidence of that. And she says, appropriately, how can you know there was no evidence if you didn't check for it? And he said, if you're checking for stuff that isn't there, you're wasting your time and the taxpayers' money. So that's the level of intelligent response you get when you ask these guys any question about it. So they just ignore. So it's unscientific from beginning to end. I quote a former employee of NIST who said that NIST has been completely hijacked from the political, from the scientific into the political realm, so that the scientists there no longer have any scientific independence. They have to say what they're told to say by the Commerce Department, by the National Security Agency, and by the Office of Management and Budget, which is a political, is an arm of the White House.
And I would call what you just described circular logic, but that's not fair to logic.
That's right. It's not even circular logic. It's just circular. So, and then the fault is, you know, I go in that there is a distinction between being unscientific and false, but in this case, there's no distinction because the same evidence that shows it's unscientific shows it's false. And by the way, for anybody who wants to know and say, well, you know, Griffin is just a philosopher of religion who's dealt a little bit with philosophy of science, how is he qualified to say these things? Well, because I can read, and I can read scientists who say these things. And if you look at the blurbs, you'll see I've got several scientists, including and also engineers and architects, endorsing this book.
And Dr. Rosie O'Donnell, too.
And Dr. Rosie O'Donnell, who probably knows a lot more about Building 7 than most of her detractors.
Really?
Oh, yeah. She
Good
was
for
hot
her.
On this. In fact, kept bringing it up on The View, and I was all scheduled. I was one day away from making my plane ticket reservation when she sort of got off the show. I mean, she did resign, but she was harassed.
They Van Jones'd her.
They Rosie O'Donnell'd Van Jones or something. So anyway, I would have been on there on national TV talking about all these things a year ago if that hadn't happened. And so given the fact that, I did ask Rosie if she would endorse the book, and she said yes. And Rosie knows what a blurb is. She wrote a very short blurb. She says, David Ray Griffin has written a powerful book that asks disturbing questions and seeks to debunk myths about September 11th. It is provocative, well-researched, and beyond convincing.
Yeah, I concur. The book is out in soft cover, $20 from Olive Branch Press. Again, the full title, The Mysterious Collapse of World Trade Center 7, Why the Final Official Report About 9/11 is Unscientific and False. And for our listeners, we have initiated a new interactive system here where you can call in and, using voicemail, contribute questions and comments to the Peter B. Collins Show. We just got it up a few days ago, and so we didn't get any calls in that are on topic for Dr. Griffin today. You can use it, though, if you want to send us a comment about the interview. We might include it in a future podcast. You're always welcome to leave comments there. And the toll-free number is 888-5-PETER-B. You dial 1-888-5-PETER-B, 888-573-8372. I did get a couple of questions by email for Professor Griffin. These two are from Craig, who is familiar with your book, God, Power, and Evil. And he has two questions. Can you comment on 9/11 and your undertakings in terms of theology and theodicy? And number two, does this nation lack someone with a suitably charismatic, social, spiritual, progressive persona who could strike deep chords of across-the-culture, humanly spiritual resonance within us? That's an interesting question.
Actually, I think there are many of those people. The problem is that they cannot get mainstream coverage, and you cannot get a mass movement going, or at least it's very, very difficult unless you get mainstream coverage. And almost by definition, the mainstream is not going to give airtime to someone who might do that sort of thing. Back to the first question. In my work in philosophy of religion, I had two major areas for most of my career. I focused on the problem of evil and then the relation between science and religion. So as I indicated a second ago, I did do a lot of work in philosophy of science, which helped with this book. But the evil, I think it also helped in the sense that I still am amazed. I talk to so many people who are very worldly people, and they know what's going on in the world, and yet they will say, I just can't bring myself to believe that Bush-Cheney administration would do such an evil thing. I know they've done some bad things, but they couldn't do, I just can't. And I'm afraid my work, having really, really studied a lot and read a lot of literature, a lot of history, from the point of view of the problem of evil and what we used to call man's inhumanity to man, I'm afraid nothing shocks me anymore. And so when I first was told the idea that 9/11 was an inside job, that was my knee-jerk reaction. I did say, I don't think the Bush administration, even the Bush administration, would do such a thing. But a few months later, when I was presented with the evidence in Paul Thompson's complete 9/11 timeline,
yeah,
then I saw very quickly there was so much evidence contrary to the official theory that it didn't take very long to switch me over. And so, yes, I could come to believe that. So I think it probably enabled me to move more quickly than I might have if I hadn't have had that background.
And, Professor, when I've looked at this, I think of, okay, if you were going to construct a scenario like this, and I'm now talking about an inside job scenario, if you were going to do that, you would want to build in, and forgive my language here, but we're no longer under the FCC rules, but what I would call the mindfuck element. And that is that if you peel back the layers and drill down to the facts, that it will be so dark, so overwhelming, and lead you to have to question your assumptions about the basic humanity of people who have been our political leaders, that you just don't want to go there. That it is such a can of worms, you know, whatever phrase you want to use, that people will be repelled by it, and they will accept the mythology because the alternative is so distasteful and unacceptable.
Yeah, I think that's true, and I do run into a lot of that, and I've had people just recently tell me that on the one hand they know the evidence, but on the other hand they just keep coming back and can't quite believe it for that reason. I think there the fact, people ask me the fact that I'm a theologian, does that help or hurt? I think it does help because I've thought a lot about, of course, questions about God and what does it mean to believe in God. And the other actual main topic that I'd worked on in the years leading up to 9/11 were on global problems and the need to focus on the global good, the general good, as opposed to nationalism, where the moral thing to do is work for your own country in competition with other countries, and that competition, of course, gets very deadly at times when you're fighting over oil and land and such and water. That to be a theist, as I am, is to be committed to the general good, the global good, above the nationalist good. It doesn't mean you're no longer an American, and it doesn't mean you no longer care about the welfare of your country, but it means you don't put that number one. It means you put truth number one, even if the truth is detrimental, at least in the short run, to your own country's political and economic welfare. So I think that this is a further answer to the questioner's question. I think that part of my background did make a difference.
Yeah. Going to take a short break and continue with Professor David Ray Griffin. You're listening to the Peter B. Collins Show. Our program is sponsored by the Organic Wine Company. Now that you're eating organic, it's time to drink organic. try the fine, earth-friendly wines imported by the Organic Wine Company since way back last century in 1980. Click on the link on my homepage at peterbcollins.com for a special introductory offer for you. David Ray Griffin is many things, and I think prolific is an accurate description. 35 books that he's published, and I didn't want this one to get lost. It was published earlier this year, Professor. Osama Bin Laden, Dead or Alive. And tell me what prompted you to publish this volume.
Yeah, it would be easy for this one to get lost. It's such a little book. It's under 100 pages. And originally, I did think of it as being an internet piece, but it got pretty long. And somebody said, well, instead of a very long internet article, why don't you make it a very little book? And so I approached my publisher, and he said, sure, let's go with it. I got started because there have been reports over the years that Osama bin Laden is dead and has been for some time. And I thought that might well be true, but I hadn't looked into it systematically until Robert Baer, about a year ago now, was on Fresh Air with Terry Gross on NPR, and was being interviewed. And in passing, he said something about Osama bin Laden being dead. She came back a minute ago, kind of gasping, and said, did you say... You think Osama bin Laden is dead? And he said, well, of course he's dead, and then he gave his reasons why. And so that got me started, and I actually got in touch with him, which is interesting part of an evolution, because he wrote one of the first critical reviews of my book when The Nation magazine, after it had refused and refused and refused to do a review, it finally hired this former CIA operative to write a review. And surprise, surprise, it was a negative review.
The Nation has not been friendly to truth-seeking around stolen elections or the events of 9/11. And I love the magazine. I've been a subscriber for over 30 years, and I cannot explain that.
Yeah, well, I say they're just one of the many, many, the majority of the left-wing magazines and websites that do not. There are very few who do, who will even countenance us, even allow us to speak. You know?
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, that was my background with Robert Baer, and but then I developed a relationship with him around this issue, and so I started going through systematically and looking at the evidence, and sure enough, it was much stronger than I even dreamed it might be. The big three pieces of evidence, one little hint is the funeral announcement.
Maybe he staged his funeral so he could see just who loved him.
Well, yeah, and that's why the funeral announcement itself wouldn't be very strong, because you can imagine many motives for doing that. Get the U.S. off his tail. Say, oh, I'm dead now, so leave me alone. The other thing was, and that's funeral announcement said mid-December was when he died.
And that's 2001. Very, that's important to note. All the way back in 2001.
December 2001, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But the other crucial thing that Baer stressed was that all the CIA had been intercepting his phone messages up till then, radio messages up till then. And
just a quick note, James Bamford has published the satellite telephone number that Osama bin Laden was using when they were conducting those intercepts.
Ah.
So I'm a little more familiar with that. It's in his book, Shadow Factory.
Oh, well, I should have known that, but I didn't. If we do a second edition, I'll get that added.
Okay.
In any case, those one day suddenly came to an end, and permanently came to an end. So just all of a sudden, no more interceptions. And Baer says, the fellow just fell off the face of the earth. And by that he meant the CIA absolutely and permanently lost track of him, and he said this has never happened before in all his years in the CIA. that they would lose track of somebody who was still alive.
Mm-hmm.
So you put those two things together, and that losing track of occurs, it looks like, December 13th or 14th, and then they say he died and was buried on mid-December. So if you took that to be the 15th, that's pretty pretty good timing.
Mm-hmm.
And then thirdly, the third strong bit of evidence is the fact that he was suffering from diabetes to all intents. And mm-hmm. in fact, Dr. Sanjay Gupta, the most famous doctor in America, was on CNN in January of 2002 analyzing the latest of the authentic, indubitably authentic bin Laden messages. And he says he looks like he's in the final stages of renal failure, meaning kidney failure.
Yeah.
And likewise, and something I didn't put in the book, I've learned another thing for the second edition, is that CBS News had reported that on September 10th, the night before 9/11, bin Laden was in a hospital in Pakistan being treated for kidney, with a dialysis machine.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got all that evidence that he was about to die, and then you get these reports that all interceptions stopped, and then that he had a funeral. You put those three together, it's pretty strong evidence. And then the fourth thing is the other side, which is, well, what about all these audio tapes and videotapes? Don't they prove he is still alive?
Well, and we'll get to that in a moment. I wanted to talk about a couple. You detail here in sequence the various references, public comments, or media accounts that suggest or flatly state that Osama bin Laden was dead at that time. One that you have here goes all the way back to January of 2002, and Pervez Musharraf, who was our guy running Pakistan at the time, is quoted on CNN, "I think now, frankly, he is dead for the reason he is a kidney patient."
Right.
And so that's one area of speculation from Pakistan. One of the others that I didn't see in your book, Professor, was from Benazir Bhutto.
You didn't read the footnotes.
Okay, I didn't. You're right.
Yeah.
So tell me what you thought of her, because I believe, let's see, she was assassinated in December of 2008, and I believe she gave an interview after she returned to Pakistan and shortly before her assassination, where she said that she believed that bin Laden was dead.
Yeah, and it was a case of misspeaking. She was on the David Frost show, and it's in a footnote because I added it at the last minute because I had added another quotation from another former intelligence person besides Bear, who had spoken out recently, Angela Cotavia, who now teaches at Boston University. And he had quoted the Bhutto statement as evidence. And so, you know, adding it at the last minute, there was only room to put it in a end note.
I see.
And so that's why it's there. Mm-hmm. It should have been in the text.
Okay. And you think it was not credible that she was speculating, or what?
Yeah, and I quote in there a guy on the web who has gone through and shown that, you know, he says she didn't mean to say Osama bin Laden.
Mm-hmm.
She's quoting, she says, she's referring to a guy named Omar Sheikh, and he's known, he was the one who actually wired the money to Muhammad Atta, reportedly, but he's also known primarily as the guy who murdered Daniel Pearl.
Mm.
But just before that conversation with David Frost, she had been talking about the bin Laden boys, some of the sons. So she had bin Laden on her mind. And so she said, Omar Sheikh, the man who killed Osama bin Laden. Mm. David Frost didn't even notice it. He didn't react.
Mm-hmm.
I understand they have since edited that out, which some people think is a conspiracy.
Yeah.
I think it's just because it was a misspe- And so he explains that the very next day she was being interviewed by CNN, and she said, well, I don't think President Musharraf even knows where Osama bin Laden is. And about a week later, she's talking to somebody else, and she says, this guy's in, watching me at my house, kind of house arrest and or protection or whatever it was. And I say to him, well, why are you doing this? Shouldn't you be out looking for Osama bin Laden?
Mm-hmm.
So it seems very clear that she simply misspoke.
All right. You also cite some comments attributed to Michael Scheuer, and he ran the bin Laden unit called the Alec Desk or Alec Unit that was named after his son. I've interviewed Scheuer many times, and he's an unusual guy.
Mm-hmm.
On the positive side, I've never met anybody more polite who calls me sir as often as he does. On the other hand, I was really troubled by some comments he made here in 2009, essentially asking for another terrorist attack on our country. And I found that not only distasteful, but inappropriate. But he is an interesting source. And let me go back to Bamford's book for a moment, because Scheuer told Bamford that he was in a struggle, CIA was in a struggle with NSA. NSA was able to capture the satellite phone conversations of bin Laden, mostly in communication with the command center in Yemen. And in the PBS documentary for, not Frontline, but the science unit, Bamford detailed, he actually took a film crew to this house in Yemen where the satellite phone calls of Osama bin Laden were received. And Scheuer was so frustrated because the NSA would not share the intercepts with the CIA. So Scheuer set up his own station to intercept these satellite phone calls, but he was only able to get one leg of it, the portion from Yemen to the satellite, not the portion from Osama's sat phone up to the bird. And so Scheuer went to great lengths of creating a transcript of the half of the conversation that his agents of the CIA were able to intercept, and he sent them over to NSA and said, okay, now will you let me see the whole thing? And they said, no.
Hmm.
It's just bizarre.
Yeah, like you say, Scheuer's an interesting fellow. You can't, there's a lot there we can learn from him.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, he says some things that, he's one who keeps saying, that bin Laden is still alive, and even though he had shut down the bin Laden unit several years ago, which suggested that he didn't think he was still alive or knew he wasn't still alive.
Mm-hmm.
But he claims that, oh, he just shut it down because there was so much bickering going on. Well, if you're out to get the number one terrorist in the world, would you shut down your unit because there was too much bickering? I think I would maybe get rid of the guys who were causing the bickering and keep the mission going.
Yeah.
So I just didn't find that credible.
So let's turn now to the audio tapes and certain videotapes, and you detail them one by one as they have been reported in the Western media. And as a group, are there some of certain eras that you find to be probably credible, I guess the best way to put it?
I have not seen any that I would see any reason to, given the fact that all the evidence that he's dead, been dead since 2001, given the fact that some of them are obviously fakes, given the fact that there's no way actually to authenticate something, the voice morphing, digital morphing is now so sophisticated that people in the field say there's no way absolutely to prove something is authentic. You can prove something is inauthentic. That's not hard,
mm-hmm.
but you can't prove something really is authentic in the sense that it was so-and-so speaking at the time that he was allegedly speaking.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, I don't know any that are authentic, or I wouldn't think bin Laden had been dead since 2001. So what I spend a lot of time on is showing that some of them are obviously fakes, and then discussing, who might have done this, and then the fact that many of them appear at such convenient times for the Bush-Cheney administration, or in one case for the Blair government, that there are many, many reasons to be suspicious of them.
Yeah, let's take in particular the one that was released, 4 days before the 2004 presidential election.
Yeah, that's the... this guy. This is called the October Surprise, Bin Laden video, because it does come out just in time to help George Bush. And both Bush and Kerry attributed Bush's victory to a significant degree to this video. And the CIA itself, the analyst sitting around, one of them said, I think this was put out here to benefit Bush. And everybody nodded in agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, you also cite the late Walter Cronkite.
That's right.
He said,
I think Karl Rove put him up to it.
Yeah.
Now, he wasn't suggesting that it wasn't authentic, but that somehow Rove got to Bin Laden to make the video. But the evidence that I give is pretty strong that it was not Bin Laden. The language he uses is nothing like the Bin Laden, and I, being a theologian, am sensitive to the use of God language.
All the inshallah stuff, yeah?
Yeah, and... As Bruce Lawrence, who's the expert on Bin Laden's tapes and his language, points out that Bin Laden used the God word, or in this case the A word, Allah, a lot. And, every few phrases. and he attributed events to God. So 9/11 happened only because God allowed it to happen. But in this lecture, which it is, this guy gets up, gives a purely secular analysis, and hardly mentions God at all. And the other thing Osama mentioned, second to God, was Muhammad the Prophet. Well, in this lecture, the only Muhammad he mentions is Muhammad Atta. And that illustrates that in this guy's worldview, actors are solely human. There's no divine actor involved in human events.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, the real Osama bin Laden spoke impeccable English, according to many, many people. He actually lived in England for a while.
Yeah.
He loved the British, one of the British soccer teams.
was he a Manchester United fan?
I'm not sure which it was, but in this case, you know, all the previous videos, whether they're authentic or not, he's addressing fellow people in the Arab Muslim world. But in this case, uniquely, he was addressing the American people. Why didn't he use his impeccable English? And yet here we have him speaking Arabic as he did in all the others.
Mm-hmm.
So those are just two of the many reasons to give for doubting the authenticity of this one.
And let's just talk about one more here that was politically very beneficial to the Bush propaganda effort at the time, and that was the Zarqawi tape that was delivered or surfaced in June of 2006. And this was at a time when the war in Iraq was going very badly, and they were trying to turn Zarqawi into a central figure. And this is part of the Bush methodology over the years. Our Panamanian dictator, who's still in jail in Florida, Saddam. They love to focus on a specific individual for media purposes. And Zarqawi was used to try to tie together 9/11 and the invasion of Iraq, and to try to show that al-Qaeda was active in Iraq, even though Zarqawi really never had any direct connection to al-Qaeda. And this videotape, it was a video, was an attempt to establish that connection.
Yes, and...
I did misspeak. It was an audio tape, not a video.
That's right.
Yeah.
And this is one that the mainstream press did... deal with, because it wasn't questioning whether Osama bin Laden was alive or not, but it did show that the U.S. Military propaganda machine set up this New York Times reporter, Dexter Filkins, to publish this explosive story that showed this evidence that, this al-Qaeda in Iraq, or al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia, as it was alternative called. was a going thing and that this guy was in touch with Osama bin Laden. So that's what this so-called intercepted message was a message from Zaghari to the leaders in Afghanistan, presumably Osama bin Laden.
Mm-hmm.
And so then, a while later, you get this bin Laden tape that is allegedly the response to Zaghari in recognition of him as the leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq. So that the right-wing supporters of the Bush initiative in Iraq could say, okay, you were saying there's no proof of al-Qaeda in Iraq and no connection between Iraq and bin Laden. This disproves it.
Mm-hmm.
That's Bill Sapphire of the New York Times.
Interesting. Well, Professor, this is a fascinating book, and I encourage people to pick it up as well because...
Oh, let me mention one word about it.
Yeah,
by
go ahead.
By the way, people over here may not have heard about it because the press won't even cover this, even though it's not a 9/11 inside job book. I never discussed that issue.
Mm-hmm.
I just discussed the question whether Osama bin Laden is dead or alive, which should have some relevance to the question of whether we ought to be in Afghanistan searching for him.
Yeah.
But our press won't cover it, but the UK press did. I got two big reviews over there. And so on Amazon UK, not AmericanAmazon.com, but Amazon UK, this book went way to the top of the charts for a few days.
Really?
And it shows you that if you can get a book review in a major, this was the major newspaper in terms of circulation, the Daily Mail.
Mm-hmm.
In England, you know, people are interested in these things, and they will get informed. But our press over here wants to keep our people ignorant. It sounds like.
Now there was $25 million in bounty put on the head of Osama bin Laden. As I recall, the language was dead or alive. So, are you planning to submit this manuscript for the $25 million?
No, it won't qualify because he has to be, I would have to produce the body.
I see.
And, or, you know, either alive or dead.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I won't get the $25 million.
Okay. Well, Professor, thank you for spending...
But if I do, I'll share it with you, Peter.
Oh, you're very kind. Thank you for spending this extended period of time with us today. And from the bottom of my heart, thank you for all the work you have done on these critical issues. It probably gets lonely out there at times, and I just want you to know there are like-minded people who really respect and appreciate what you've been doing.
Well, thanks to people like you, I'm not quite so lonely. Thank you.
All right. Good to talk with you again. Thanks for listening to this edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Your comments are welcome at 888-5-PETER-B or email peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.